Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And, you know, I need to do a go back. We've got Paul with us, and so welcome back, Paul. And
hey, GR, thanks.
I'm not sure if you listened to my show yesterday on the presidential election episodes, but one thing that was kind of bothering me and something that I was kind of ruminating or cogitating on was, you know, we hear, you know, all of this lip service from our government and from our corporations, or these multi-conglomerate, these global corporations that, you know, all of a sudden have this social responsibility that they're you know, going to try to, you know, make things right for the people. And, you know, this is nothing more than, I'll just say, arrogance, and this is truly the epitome of patronizing, you know, us citizens. Because really, I want to put this into perspective. What they're talking about regarding social responsibility isn't trying to get you the products that you really need that will help you become productive and be able to, you know, grow your wealth and grow your, you know, your affluence and so forth, to actually improve every facet of your life. What they are doing is they're using what they call social responsibility that preaches their ideology or religious dogma, all the while they're increasing their profit margins and reducing their competition by using government to go after those people who dare to compete with them. Now, when you really think about this, wouldn't social responsibility simply be reducing their profits instead of spending their money and investing in this communist statist ideology of literally eliminating competition and actually destructive ideologies? Because many of these globalists are the ones that are actually pushing the homosexual agenda, you know, the woke agenda, all of these, you know, overarching destructive agendas. Wouldn't the social responsibility be really what government should be doing is reducing the length of patents and copyrights, which would truly benefit all in society, not just those pernicious policies?
Hey, you want to add something to that?
Sure.
I just saw this in the news this morning that Ford has gotten a $9 billion loan from the government for their electric car production. Okay. Can't produce on it. You know, it's not sustainable. So they get help from the government.
From the taxpayers, to subjugate us. In other words, they're making these because it's all about control, creating vehicles that they have better control over.
There it is. I just found it. Right. Actually, this is 4 days ago. Ford gets $9.2 billion loan from the Department of Energy for EV battery production. How's that?
Right. Now, so the one thing that's always overarching, and I just want to end this little
rant.
Go back. Okay. Regarding the talents, you know, the parable of talents. See, we all, regardless of where we are, whether we're a baron or captain of industry, or whether we're just a person that's, you know, the head of a family, or, you know, the mother, it doesn't matter where we are in life. I believe the parable of talents applies to every person, that we live, you know, with these talents that we're given. And the parable is very clear that those who try to magnify their talents and make the most of what they've been given, then, you know, and not at the expense of others. I mean, there's all these other overarching, you know, doctrines that, you know, we got to do unto others as you do unto yourself and those types of things. But anyway, we have this responsibility. And so when we actually see government doing things where they are, you know, where they have the opportunity to optimize one's talents. And you probably didn't listen to yesterday's show, but the optimizing of talents is by, you know, making sure that every possible obstacle in your way of having the most productive life, like, you know, unlimited electrical energy by subscription instead of paying by the kilowatt, because by paying by the kilowatt, they're making profits. But getting it to a point where they can actually provide subscription based, where, you know, it's literally, you know, what the cost is and there's no profits involved. These are public utilities. So optimizing those types of things, as far as I see that, that's something government could actually be doing, but they're not. And as a matter of fact, it's all about the fleecing of America. So what is government actually doing? They're obstructing and manipulating our society to basically bury our tenants, to hinder us and keep us from magnifying, you know, and actually they're the antithesis of an enlightened society, as I've kind of covered that over the time, of becoming disciplined and improving our productivity and improving society's mores and so forth overall. And we're heading down that path. And that's why, you know, I'm going to go back to it's now or never, folks. We really need to step up. So
GR, before you get away from this point, you and I discussed this before, but I don't know if we discussed it in front of an audience. And one of the things you mentioned was utilities by subscription. Yeah. And what I want to address is the
You've signed an NDA, the non-disclosure agreement, because I've talked to you about that whole how we could do that. And so, because if that gets public, there's no doubt in my mind that those concepts would be actually pursued and buried, so that we would not ever be able to do that.
That's okay. But what I want to address, is a perception in people's minds that the government takeover of public utilities. You understand what I'm saying? So, in other words, you've got public utilities making a profit.
Oh, yeah.
And you've got this mindset in the public about, hey, why would the government take over utilities? And I'd like you to address that, because at some point it's gone from, you know, cooperatives to profit adventures.
Right. So actually they're not public utilities anymore. Technically, we don't have public utilities in America. These are profit-based utility systems. And so what ended up happening was they realized when they created this national system, power and all of this other stuff, that even though it was a statist thing, they go, you know what? We're kind of cutting our noses by our face, because we're giving people cheap stuff and they're taking advantage of it and they're getting better off, and we don't have the ability to control them. And so they recognize that by taking away as much of our discretionary spending out of our budget as possible to hurt us financially as much as possible, so that we can barely make ends meet, then they're getting us to the point where they can control us. And that's really why we're in this situation. There's no reason why they don't take these things back from these private companies, from usually your water district is still a public utility, but power, because that is a subscription type of thing. You know, once they've created it, the water just flows. But power is something that they've said, oh, well, we have to generate this. And they're going down the paths of making it more expensive and more. They want to actually have a shortage. It goes back to that concept what Milton Friedman stated, give the federal government the power to regulate the Sahara Desert and they'll run out of sand in 5 years.
Okay, so as historically, were utilities actually public or a service instead of profit-making ventures they are now?
Yeah.
Because...
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. There was civil engineering. It was all done by the taxpayer dime. You know, it's kind of like your freeway systems. Your freeway systems, all freeway systems were done by taxpayer dimes. And then the government gets in bed with some company, some private company, of creating these things called fast lanes, these fast tracks, or these, you know, through fares, or toll turnpikes on the East Coast, where you pay to drive that road. Well, you know, that road wasn't, you know, carved out of the wilderness by a private company. It was just added lanes to what the federal government had already improved, or, you know, the state government, if it's a state turnpike. But bottom line, you know, they're taking advantage using, you know, the benefits of what's been done with the tax dollars to create a mechanism to fleece us for more. And isn't it their responsibility to help us become more productive? If we've got clogged arteries of roadways, whose fault is that? It's government's poor planning. They saw at the turn of the century, the turn of the 20th century, they saw cities becoming bigger and bigger. And as they started planning for cars, they only did what was necessary. And they kept us throttling us and keeping us from being as, you know, there's no reason why that we don't have other means of types of transportation besides just cars. We could actually be going in lots of different directions. And it would probably even be cheaper than a car. But they don't want that. They want to keep us contained so that they know where we are. Because, you know, if you could actually fly to work, you could take any route you wanted.
So I've got the precise example of what you're talking about. There's a guy that developed, literally developed a flying car. Okay. And here's where the Department of Transportation came in and kind of shut him down, because the development cost, the cost to submit something like that and do the testing, realize they had to pay the government something like $1 million just to get this thing off the ground. You hear that? So in other words, they throttled this thing down. And then they pretty much shut him down. It's been his life work, okay? If anyone's ever interested, it's Moeller.com, Moeller International. And he's got this engine, he's got this concept, and the government has fought him every step of the way. He's been doing this for over 60 years.
Right.
Okay? just an example, what you were talking about.
Yeah. So, you know, the means of how we travel on a road and how we travel through the air or what have you, it should be, and it is a competitive market, but there's no way we can compete in creating our own road system to go wherever we want to go. In other words, the infrastructure, the government needs to have that. And to have these private roads and all of these other things, it's all about fleecing us, folks. That's all it is. And they're getting better and better at taking away what little disposable income, because those people that have a little more disposable income, well, they'll pay that extra, you know, floating price, because that's exactly how these fast tracks work. Oh, and when the traffic's busier and it's more painful, they charge you more. When you really need it more, they charge you more. So how is that helping you? All that's doing is incentivizing you to actually stop traveling, you know, by yourself, and to force you into either public transportation because you can't afford it. Those people over there can, and eventually those people over there won't be able to, because once they're done with us, they'll be going after them. They want to control everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why Bill Gates, you know, has become and submitted himself as a league in globalism and subjugation, because he's actually got to the top of what he believes is the food chain.
Right.
And so he doesn't recognize that this is a, you know, even though it's a pyramid, it's an our society is technically an inverse pyramid. And this is what Aristotle talks about. He goes, you know, all of the power is with the people, that, you know, when those under us, that, you know, what we would say rule us, they have to tiptoe that fine balance of being able to keep us happy, keep us fed and all of that. Because if not, we revolt and destroy them.
Mm.
Because that's the cause of the primary causes of revolution. This is in Aristotle's Politics. When the people are starving, they blame government. Or when they see government obtaining, you know, opulence and, you know, obscene powers and affluence, where, you know, these people are better than us, that's the other reason why they'll actually revolt, is, you know, to take that power back away from them.
Right.
So anyway, we've digressed a lot. And
a little bit.
And we've got the Virginia ratification debates, and at this point in time, we're still talking about Madison. And Madison actually dives into, and I think this is the first time we hear him talk about the importation of slaves. Now, just remember, you know, Madison was the one during the Constitutional Convention that actually, you know, complained. I mean, he was the one that literally said, who's going to remember that this clause even exists in the Constitution in 20 years? And the irony was that he became president, you know, at that very particular point in time, those 20 years later, where he actually did remember. I mean, it was just providence of all of that.
Right.
But here's what he had to say.
Okay.
Go ahead.
This is Mr. Madison replied. That even the southern states, which were most affected, were perfectly satisfied with this provision and dreaded no danger to the property they now hold. It appeared to him that the general government would not intermeddle with that property for 20 years, but to lay a tax on every slave imported not exceeding $10, and that after the expiration of that period, they might prohibit the traffic altogether. The census in the Constitution was intended to introduce equality in the burdens to be laid on the community. No gentleman objected to laying duties, imposts, and excises uniformly, but uniformity of taxes would be subversive of the principles of equality. What? Okay, I'm pausing here because I'm surprised by this sentence. No,
keep going. Keep going.
Okay.
Just
all right. For it was not possible to select any article which would be easy for one state, but what would be heavy for another, that the proportion of each state being ascertained, it would be raised by the general government in the most convenient manner for the people, and not by the selection of any particular object, that there must be some degree of confidence put in agents, or else we must reject a state of civil society altogether.
Okay, I'll answer this. One of the very first things that Hamilton tried to tax was the sale of horses. And so, because it was kind of like an excise tax. And the uniformity clause really applies to all the different taxes, duties, excises, and imposts. And so they had to be uniform so that it wouldn't have an adverse effect. Because when he's talking about equality of the burden that government is laying upon the states. And so when this taxation or this excise tax on the sale of horses was fronted, well, the majority of all the horses in America were in the agrarian states or the southern states. They were the ones that were buying and selling them. And so those in the north who were moving and gravitating towards cities and so forth, many of them didn't have horses. I mean, they may have one horse to draw their buggy and wagon or whatever, but they didn't have a whole bunch of horses to plow fields and use for work and so forth. And so it was brought up, hey, you create that tax and that will be unequal, or it'll be an unequal burden upon the states, that the southern states would be paying the majority of that burden.
Right.
Right.
That
makes sense, right? Okay.
Yes, it does.
Okay.
Another great security to this property, which he mentioned, was that five states were greatly interested in that species of property. And there were other states which had some slaves and had made no attempt or taken any step to take them from the people. There were a few slaves in New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. These states would probably oppose any attempts to annihilate this species of property. He concluded by observing that he should be glad to leave the decision of this to the committee. Okay, here's something else that surprises me. He's speaking of northern states, and then he says that these states would oppose any attempts to annihilate this species of property. That's a surprise to me also.
Right.
New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. What is he talking about there?
Well, so even though the states were moving towards the abolition movement and the freeing of slaves, all the north, because we see that as it was being stated, but he was being pragmatic, saying that you know that no state wants to trample upon, as repugnant as this sounds, no state or no government at that point in time where it's a perceived property wants to trample upon the property rights of people. Remember, the two objects that, people instituted government was for the protection of life and protection of their property.
Mm-hmm.
And so when government all of a sudden starts dictating that you can't have that type of property, then yeah. Even though the mores had been shifting, the Declaration of Independence, which was only just, going on 2 decades, where the ink was drying on that. The Declaration of Independence was, something that was brought up by the Brain Trust. I mean, this was not done in a uniform, societal type of thing with this Declaration of Independence that all men were created equal. There were plenty of people that, probably didn't even understand the magnitude of, some of those words. And so this kind of points out that, these framers were leading this nation. A lot of people say this every once in a while. I think they casually say this, that here were these men with such affluence and influence over the government and the shape and the direction the government was. Remember, the ratification debates were those who were the who's who in politics that went there. I mean, everybody was just being cycled around. Oh, that guy was a politician. He was, maybe had understanding of law or what have you, but politicians were an elite class at that time. And here is the epitome of how mores have an effect on government, because the mores of the people were so honorable that these men didn't create a corrupt system for themselves.
Mm.
These men still allowed people to make the mistakes, whether it be maintaining slavery or, whatever, the mistakes that people made. This was America, and you had a right to make your mistakes. Government's job isn't to, and this was kind of like this epoch, or this was a turning point of moving away from blue laws, as people understand it, because government didn't have the business of actually creating laws to protect people from themselves. That wasn't their job.
Blue laws,
right. The blue law is basically laws that, say that we know better than you, and we're not going to allow you to drink. We're not going to allow you to have, right, these types of things. And that's what a blue law is. And right. And there were plenty of states that had blue laws. The federal government was stripped of that concept.
Mm-hmm.
And other states, and many of the states, some of them took a long time, but they finally got to a point where they said government doesn't have this position of doing that. And then the progressive era began, and where government said, we were wrong. We do need to start controlling these things. We need to. And it was all under this guise of good intentions, giving you safer meat, taking away the predatory practices of corporations and business. And, it was all under this guise that, hey, we're here for the common man. All the time, they were taking up more and more power, and they were benefiting those corporations that were actually in league with them. Most people think that as they broke up Standard Oil, that hurt Standard Oil, but it didn't.
Right. And no, it didn't.
Right. And what it did, and we've ran out of time. We're going into the break here. And so what it did was, you know, breaking up Standard Oil and all of that, all it did was it gave Standard Oil, as it was broken up, you know, more strength in developing itself in these other market spaces and creating different market spaces, which is why you see all of those companies that fell away from that, like pharmaceutical companies and everything else. They're just giants. We'll be right back after this promo, folks.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our Constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contribution page, and you can become a listed supporter of Liberty. Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, so I hope that all makes sense, because, you know, if you look at globalism, there has been a partnership, and it all started under the progressive era, this partnership of corporations and government working together. And right. So, I mean, it was literally different stages. And I personally was involved in one of the stages in 1984, where I was actually at the World Economic Forum. Or it was called the World Forum at that time, and it was former President Gerald Ford who hosted it in Vail, Colorado. I was serving as a Marine at this function, and I was kind of astounded. I thought it was really cool that here we've got government, banking, and industries working together to try to maximize, you know, their optimum, you know, market space and everything else. And I started realizing that what they were really doing was figuring out how they could chisel more, you know, chisel away more at the Americans' budget, the American, you know, economics of each household. And, right. You know, and the whole point of that was, as they started separating, and they make us more and more desperate because we have less and less money to spend, you know, it makes us easier to control.
Yes. So one more thing before we get away from it.
Sure.
And you talk about Madison was concerned that this wouldn't even be remembered. He had no idea that 20 years later he would be president.
He had no idea. Correct. Right.
But what he's expressing there, but I guess he was concerned that this would get away from, it would get lost down the memory hole. Right?
Right.
He was really concerned that, you know, it would just go away. But, you know, God praise.
Yeah. So to be clear here, mm-hmm. he's speaking in Virginia, which was a state. See, remember, at the Constitutional Convention, the five delegates of Virginia all were okay with eradicating slavery.
Right.
There were only three states that, you know, weren't okay with it. And this was one of these compromises. And so, to be honest, this was the comeuppance of what they had to face because, you know, and Patrick Henry was basically pretty clear when he basically, I can picture him shaking his finger of judgment, you know, at the Federalists and those who wanted this Constitution, because I believe he actually said that they're going to take away your slaves from you He was warning them that this was, you know, this was the whole concept behind the Constitution, which further supports the this, as we've been showing you and the listeners, as you've been reading this, that it has been already articulated in Pennsylvania and Massachusetts that these compromises placed inside the Constitution were going to actually help eradicate slavery. And so here Madison is, you know, talking to a host of delegates of Virginia, many of them probably slave owners. And, hey, you know, what are you trying to do here? What does this mean? We need this, right? And so he basically said, oh, you know, even the southern states, which are most affected, were perfectly satisfied with this provision. Mm-hmm. And he goes, so what do we have to complain about? Because they weren't considered, believe it or not, they weren't considered the southern states, even though they became a part of the, you know, the Confederacy. But anyway.
But were they satisfied? Here's my point. Were they satisfied with the provision? Because they also believed that it might fall down the memory hole.
Yeah, so so Madison makes this comment and he ends, right? This is his final comment of everything he stated. And so who speaks next? It's Mason. And if you look at what Mason talks about, he talks about, you know, he doesn't go on about slavery. Why? Because he himself was a huge critic against slavery. He was the one that said in the convention, every slave owner is a petty tyrant. And so his next comment, he doesn't even bring up slavery. See my point? And so, you know, here was another delegate who's not a Federalist. He's an anti-Federalist that didn't even want to touch this. He didn't even want to go back into this. So, you know, there wasn't a lot of people that were trying to make hay. And because Mason happened to be, and it may have been a godsend, having a real anti-slavery person as the anti-Federalist, one of the principal anti-Federalist spokesmen in Virginia. You know, he just refused to make any hay or any point out of, you know, these what we'll call compromises in the Constitution over slavery.
Okay.
So moving on, there's a lot of people to talk, and then we get down to Governor Randolph.
Okay, and here's a note. He says, let me say that. Is this the same subject or something different?
Now, this is a different subject now. They've kind of migrated, but go ahead.
All right. Let me say that, in my opinion, the adversaries of the Constitution wander equally from the true meaning. If it would not fatigue the House too far, I would go back to the question of reserved rights. The gentleman supposes that complete and unlimited legislation is vested in the Congress of the United States. This supposition is founded on false reasoning. What is the present situation of this state? She has possession of all rights and sovereignty, except those given to the Confederation. She must delegate powers to the Confederate government. It is necessary for her public happiness. Her weakness compels her to confederate with the 12 other governments. She trusts certain powers to the general government in order to support, protect, and defend the Union. Now, is there not a demonstrable difference between the principle of the state government and of the general government? There is not a word said in the state government of the powers given it, is given to it, because they are general. But in the general Constitution, its powers are enumerated. It is not, then, fairly deducible that it has no power but what is expressly given it? For if its powers were to be general, an enumeration would be needless. He goes on.
Right.
But the insertion of the negative restrictions has given cause of triumph, it seems, to gentlemen. They suppose that it demonstrates that Congress are to have powers by implication. I will meet them on that ground. I persuade myself that every exception here mentioned is an exception, not from general powers, but from the particular powers herein there invested. To what power in the general government is the exception made respecting the importation of Negroes? Not from a general power, but from a particular power expressly enumerated. This is an exception from the power given them of regulating commerce. He asks, where is the power to which the prohibition of suspending the habeas corpus is an exception? I contend that by virtue of the power given to Congress to regulate courts, they can suspend the writ of habeas corpus. This is therefore an exception to that power. The third restriction is that no bill of attainder or ex post facto law shall be passed. This is a manifest exception to another power. We know well that attainders and ex post facto laws have always been the engines of criminal jurisprudence. This is therefore an exception to the criminal jurisdiction vested in that body. The fourth restriction is that no capitation or other direct tax shall be laid unless in proportion to the census before directed to be taken. Our debates show from what power this is an exception. The restrictions on the fifth clause are an exception to the power of regulating commerce. The restrictions in the sixth clause that no money should be drawn from the treasury but in consequence of appropriations made by law is an exception to the power of paying the debts of the United States, for the power of drawing money from the treasury is consequential of that of paying the public debts. The next restriction is that no titles of nobility shall be granted by the United States. If we cast our eyes to the manner in which titles of nobility first originated, we shall find this restriction founded on the same principles. These sprang from military and civil offices. Both are put in the hands of the United States, and therefore I presume it to be an exception to that power. The last restriction restrains any person in office from accepting of any present or emolument title or office from any foreign prince or state. It must have been observed before that though the Confederation had restricted Congress from exercising any powers not given them, yet they inserted it not from an apprehension of usurpation, but for greater security. This restriction is provided to prevent corruption. All men have a natural inherent right to receive emoluments from anyone, unless they be restrained by the regulations of the community. An accident which actually happened operated in producing the restriction. A box was presented to our ambassador by the king of our allies. It was thought proper, in order to exclude corruption and foreign influence, to prohibit anyone in office from receiving or holding any emoluments from foreign states. I believe that if at that moment, when we were in harmony with the King of France, we had supposed that he was corrupting our ambassador, it might have disturbed that confidence and diminished that mutual friendship which contributed to carry us through the war. The honorable gentleman observed that Congress might define punishments from petty larceny to high treason. This is an unfortunate quotation. Or the gentleman, because treason is expressly defined in the third section of the third article, and they can add no feature to it. They have not cognizance over any other crime except piracies, felonies committed on the high seas, and offenses against the law of nations. But the rhetoric of the gentleman was highly colored the dangers of giving the general government an indefinite power of providing for the general welfare. I contend that no such power is given. They have power to, quote, to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and exercises to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States, end quote. Is this an independent, separate, substantive power to provide for the general welfare of the United States? No, sir. They can lay and collect taxes, etc. For what? To pay the debts and provide for the general welfare. Were not this the case, the following part of the clause would be absurd. It would have been treason against common language. Take it all together, and let me ask if the plain interpretation be not this: a power to lay and collect taxes, etc., in order to provide for the general welfare and pay debts. On the subject of a Bill of Rights, the want of which has been complained of, I will observe that it has been sanctified by such reverend authority. that I feel some difficulty in going against it. I shall not, however, be deterred from giving my opinion on this occasion, let the consequence be what it may. At the beginning of the war, we had no certain Bill of Rights, for our charter cannot be considered as a Bill of Rights. It is nothing more than an investiture in the hands of the Virginia citizens to those of those rights which belonged to the British subjects. When the British thought proper to infringe our rights, was it not necessary to mention in our Constitution those rights which ought to be paramount to the power of the legislature? Why is the Bill of Rights distinct from the Constitution? I consider Bill of Rights in this view, that the government should use them when there is a departure from its fundamental principles in order to restore them. This is the true sense of a Bill of Rights. If it be consistent with the Constitution or contain additional rights, why not put it in the Constitution? If it be repugnant to the Constitution, here will be a perpetual scene of warfare between them. The honorable gentleman has praised the Bill of Rights of Virginia and called it his guardian angel and vilified this Constitution for not having it. Give me leave to make a distinction between the representatives of the people of a particular country who are appointed as the ordinary legislature, having no limitation to their powers, and another body arising from a compact and with certain delineated powers. Were a Bill of Rights necessary in the former, it would not be in the latter. For the best security that can be in the latter is the express enumeration of its powers. But let me ask the gentleman where his favorite rights are violated. They're not violated in the 10th section, which contains restrictions on the states. Are they violated by the enumerated powers? Here His Excellency read from the 8th to the 12th article of the Bill of Rights. Is there not provision made in this Constitution for the trial by jury in criminal cases? Does not the 3rd article provide that the trial of all crimes shall be by jury and held where the said crimes shall have been committed? Does it not follow that the cause and nature of the accusation must be produced? Because otherwise they cannot proceed on the cause. Everyone knows that the witnesses must be brought before the jury, or else the prisoner will be discharged. Calling of evidence in his favor is coincident to his trial. There is no suspicion that less than 12 jurors will be thought sufficient. The only defect is that there is no speedy trial. Consider how this could have been amended. We have heard complaints against it because it is supposed that the jury is to come from the state at large. It will be in their power to have juries from the vicinage. And would not the complaints have been louder if they had been appointed a federal court to be had in every county in the state? Criminals are brought in this state from every part of the country to the general court, and jurors from the vicinage are summoned to the trials. There can be no reason to prevent general government from adopting a similar regulation. Sure, there's more to read here, but it seems to me that he's saying that the Confederation was violating this idea of local trial by jury. Is that what he's saying here?
Yeah. So what he's doing is he's really responding to, you know, this necessity again of the Bill of Rights and so forth. So he lays out, you know, how things are enumerated and what's really, 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 really. I've highlighted it since you were reading it because it really sticks out. Because they talk about general government having indefinite powers for providing for the general welfare. And he says, I contend that no power such given. They have no power but to lay taxes, duties, imposts, and excises to pay the debts for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. Is this an independent, separate, substantive power to provide for the general welfare of the United States? No, sir. They can lay and collect taxes and et cetera. For what? To pay the debts and provide for the general welfare. were not this the case, then the following part of this clause would be absurd. It would have been treason against the common language. In other words, the following, you know, the enumerations of the powers. And so, and then he kind of lays it out. But, and then he starts going through the exceptions, and he starts laying out the bills of attainder and ex post facto laws and all these other restrictions and so forth. And then, everything is being enumerated. So what is the real problem? And it even gets into, which is the part you're going through, he even dives into their complaints about how the federal government was going to be involved in, you know, in the jury or the trial process of all things. The one thing that I think he didn't really mention was the jurisdiction of the court. And we'll hit this a little bit later on, because I think this is when John Marshall really comes up and says, look, you know, the jurisdiction of the court is only over those things arising under this Constitution. They have no jurisdiction over anything that isn't enumerated. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, but what he wants to do, because it wasn't guaranteed, but he points out that a trial, a criminal trial, is must have a trial by jury. And so, you know, as we kind of go through this, now I'm telling you, when Louisiana joined the Union, they denied their folks. I mean, I think today only those capital trials, you know, people, you know, being tried for murder or capital punishment, they get a trial by jury, but everything else is a trial by judge. And so, or, you know, what they call a magistrate. But anyway, I'm not sure if I'm answering your question, but really he's just going through the different types of complaints, and he's trying to pick all of these things off to say, look, you know, how could have this been done better?
Okay. In the paragraph that I read last, it seemed like he was contrasting that to what they had been doing in the what they may have been doing in the Confederation, because he says,
well, he was basically stating that, you know, when a trial of a criminal trial, if that, because the very last thing he was talking about was that the person charged would be brought to the state court, and then they would call or summons, you know, witnesses and or the jury as well from the vicinage. And the vicinity of where the trial was committed, or the crime.
Yeah, what he said was criminals are brought in this state from every part of the country to the general court. And so
when he's saying every part of the country, he's talking about within the state.
Okay.
Because remember, Virginia was its own country.
Okay, you know what? And you know, that speaks to the clarity they had about what the states were.
Right. They were that independent, they were that sovereign, that they were considered their own countries. That's why they're called states. States are independent and sovereign nations.
Right. That answers the question that I knew, but I wanted to clarify it. Thanks for doing it, because that's exactly what I wanted to get to. There's one more paragraph you got highlighted.
Yep, go ahead.
Do we have time to finish it?
Yeah, we do. We got 5.5 minutes. Go ahead.
Okay. As to the exclusion of excessive bail and fines and cruel and unusual punishments, this would follow of itself without a Bill of Rights. Observations have been made about watchfulness over those in power, which deserve our attention. There must be a combination. We must presume corruption in the House of Representatives, Senate, and President before we can suppose that excessive fines can be imposed and cruel punishments inflicted. Their number is the highest security. Numbers are the highest security in our own Constitution, which has attracted so many eulogiums from the gentlemen. Here we have launched into a sea of suspicions. How shall we cheek power?
By
Does
numbers.
He mean seek?
Right. So he says, he's saying cheek. You know, like how can we, you know, how can we, I guess the reference was, you know, like a tongue in cheek. How can we cheek power? And he keeps the one point that he's making that's really, really important, where this kind of points to the necessity of changing apportionment, not based on seats, but based on the necessity of the of people being represented. See, the reason we have apportionment today, folks, and let me let you finish this, and then I'll get into that.
Okay. So yeah, let me do that.
Go ahead.
Okay. So he asked, how should we check power? By their numbers. Before these cruel punishments can be inflicted, laws must be passed and judges must judge contrary to justice. This would excite universal discontent and detestation of the members of the government. They might involve their friends in the calamities resulting from it and could be removed from office. I never desire a greater security than this, which I believe to be absolutely sufficient.
So he's really pointing out the importance of having a high number, you know, having the appropriate number. In other words, by the numbers, by increasing the numbers of representation. Because if we allow, you know, there's this old phrase that I learned from a friend of mine from the Northwest Grassroots that, you know, he repeats all the time. He says, keep it small, keep it all. In other words, if you keep government, you know, kind of contained in these numbers, then you can control them. But as government, as the people grow and as the nation grows, government should grow so that the appropriate representation is being had by all. And so, and he's pointing out to this. He's saying that by the numbers, by surely having, you know, as many representatives that the people really need, I'm telling you, if we had, you know, whatever it is, I think it's just under 7,000. If we passed Madison's amendment in the Bill of Rights to control the apportionment to no more than 50,000 in its final stage, that, you know, every 50,000 people would have their own congressional district. There's no doubt in my mind that huge, you know, governing body we call the House of Representatives, which, like I said, would be just under 7,000 people, that would be very hard to corrupt, especially today, because that would be a virtual governing body.
Right.
In other words, we would now have, you know, our own representatives much closer to home, to where we could actually poke them in the eye instead of them being protected in this militant District of Columbia.
Right.
So anyway, we've got basically a minute and a half. Any other questions or anything else?
No, I think we've covered it. That answered a lot of questions that I.
Well, so to me, this really highlighted a few different points. It highlighted, one, you know, the general powers. It also highlighted, you know, this expressed thing about debt, that they could only take on debt for the need of what they had to spend their money on. In other words, they couldn't create debt for things they had no authority to spend their money on. And that's what they've been doing.
Right.
That's what they've been doing. And this is why, you know, we even have this debt clock, because technically the amount of money that they're taking from us would more than pay, you know, for what their legitimate government would be. I mean, we wouldn't even have any debt, and our taxes should go down. It would significantly go down if we actually cleaned up our system and nullified the debt, because we really don't own that, because they had no authority. And right here in the ratification debates, they even say that they can only take on debt for those legitimate expenditures, those things enumerated. And so going on about the titles of nobility and the restraints on emoluments and all of that, you know, as well as, you know, defining that the federal government only had the control. Paul, we're at the end here, so we'll bring you back tomorrow and we'll talk more about this. But this was a very, very powerful address that Governor Randolph made. And so, folks, we're giving you all of the evidence. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcast and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Moby Strip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Moby Strip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you.